You're listening to the Saturday selection on Monocle 24, highlights from the weekend edition. Hello and welcome to the Saturday selection on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin. This is your chance to hear the best of our weekend output with a selection of my favourite interviews broadcast first during the Saturday weekend edition. Well, first up in the show, we sit down with one of the most powerful women in media. That's Arianna Huffington. She tells us how to make the most of our lives.
In order to learn to disconnect from technology, reconnect with ourselves, recharge, and then return to technology, we really need to take it seriously in terms of changing habits.
Also ahead, we meet the team behind a project that demands its audience stop and smell the roses.
With radio, you have to fill in the gaps and you have to use your own memory and your own experience, and it's very immediate and it's very emotive. Smell works in a kind of very similar way. It's even talking about smell can put people in exactly that moment.
Plus, as a teenager back in 1984, he was awarded the title of being one of the foremost Sherlock Holmes fans in the world. Well, he's now all grown up and a much revered author. He is Mitch Cullen.
We have this kind of unspoken contract about Sherlock Holmes is that we all agree that he's a fictional character and we all want to believe he's real. And when you mess with that, it can elicit some strange, unpleasant reactions.
All that here on the Saturday Selection with me, Georgina Godwin. Now, cast your mind back to 1984. A new TV show based on an old book about a London detective has hit the Western world and is breeding a small army of obsessive fans. The TV show was The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, and one such fan is Mitch Cullen, who featured in USA Today back in 1984 as one of the foremost Sherlock Holmes fans in the world. Well, he's the author of six novels, including Tideland, the film adaptation was directed by Terry Gilliam, and Inverse Branches. He lives in California, and he most recently wrote A Slight Trick of the Mind, all about an ageing Sherlock Holmes. Well, I caught up with him before he was to appear at the Hay Festival. My first question had to be about his Sherlock Holmes infatuation.
Well, I was a huge Sherlock Holmes fan. I'm a bit of a lapsed Sherlockian in my adulthood, but as a boy, it's fair to say, I would like to have known then that I was the world's greatest Sherlock Holmes fan. But
Clearly the fascination continues because your book, A Slight Trick of the Mind, is in fact all about Sherlock Holmes, but Sherlock Holmes as a geriatric.
Indeed. Yeah, it's true. But this was more of my attempt to kind of look back at my childhood in a way. My father was starting to develop early signs of what we believe now was Alzheimer's or dementia. And I was kind of grappling with that, and suddenly I started to feel not so young, more of an adult. And along with that, there was a mentor of mine, a man named John Bennett Shaw, who had the world's largest Sherlock Holmes collection in the world. And it was in an adobe house in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And John had passed away in 1994, so all of that was kind of stewing around in my head. So it became a highly metaphorical kind of book as a way to kind of explore certain things of losing childhood heroes and growing older and grappling with issues of aging and things that were just kind of new to me at the time. So in a way, it's more of a goodbye to Sherlock Holmes for me.
Lots and lots of people, of course, identify with him, and he is loved by millions across the world. So it must be quite hard, actually, putting yourself into the mind of someone who so many people feel some kind of sense of ownership over.
Absolutely. And when the book first came out in the States, I got some very angry letters from people that were sent to me, kind of, how dare you? And why would you do this? And I realized that's because we have this kind of unspoken contract about Sherlock Holmes is that we all agree that he's a fictional character and we all want to believe he's real. And when you mess with that, people might perceive it as being messed with. When you make him maybe a little too human, it can elicit some strange, unpleasant reactions. With the hardcore Sherlockians, the real scholars, the response was fantastic. I felt relieved when Leslie Klinger, who's considered one of the foremost Sherlock Holmes authorities in the world, he did the new annotated Sherlock Holmes. He had done a a really wonderful review of the book in the LA Times book review. And when that came out, I kind of, okay, I'm all right. No matter what else, I'm all right with the hardcore guys. And I could have really good conversations with them. They kind of seemed to appreciate and understand what I was doing. The more casual, earnest Sherlock Holmes fan, it was a mixed kind of bag.
Because they are a voracious bunch. I mean, we're here in our studios just off Baker Street.
Oh, yeah.
And we walk past, you know, whatever it is, 22B Baker Street often. And there are crowds and crowds of people there to go and see the home that never existed of a person that never existed.
Exactly.
What's that about?
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, it tells you the power of those stories. Conan Doyle couldn't even get rid of him. You know, he created a monster that he wanted to be done with. He tried killing him off and the public wouldn't have it. Yesterday, I did an interview with the Baker Street Babes. Are you familiar with them? They are exactly what their name says. They're Baker Street Babes. And one of them has 22B tattooed on her ankle. You know, for tattoos are painful, but on your ankle is one of the most painful places to put a tattoo. So she's serious about this stuff. He's an incredible character. He's enigmatic. He's kind of the first rock star. He did cocaine. He played the violin. He's got a little bit of punk rock attitude, I think, you know, and I think he's just very vivid in people's minds.
And you reference this whole thing about hating his own fame. Within the book, you have Sherlock himself talking about John Watson and how actually what Watson has written was nonsense. It wasn't true to the fact. And he wishes he would just stop. He doesn't want to be recognized.
Yeah, it's true. I was basing that a little bit on J.D. Salinger, who I was also kind of interested in at the time. More J.D. Salinger as a person who really wanted to be a famous writer. And then he became a famous writer and really didn't want to be a famous writer anymore. And all these people, these kids that would just show up at his doorstep kind of wanting to meet him and hoping that he could somehow tell them something that would make some difference to their lives. So I imagine Sherlock Holmes, had he existed and had he kind of shied away from the public eye later in life, might be a little similar, you know, to that.
Well, you make reference in the book, of course, to people coming to him for answers. Mm. Everybody wants to have answers about their unsolved cases or about their lives.
Right.
But of course, the book is really about him looking for answers for his own life, really.
True. I mean, I think, isn't that what we're all kind of trying to do anyway? We're trying to make sense of the time we have here, and all kinds of things pop up in our lives that no one tells us they're going to happen. Our parents get ill. We see friends go. These kind of real everyday mysteries. And sometimes there's just no answer to these things. They just happen. Life just happens. And no matter how smart you are or how dumb you are, these things are just going to happen to you. They're going to happen to Sherlock Holmes, too. If we operate under the assumption that he existed, Watson will die and his family members will pass away and he might end up alone. And who would want to be around a guy like that as he got older? He might be a real jerk. You know, he'd be very annoying. He's always telling you what you've been doing and always looking at your clothes and telling you, you know, your wife's cheating on you and all that. So even, what a jerk. You know?
And he does, he comes across as a pretty irascible old man, actually.
Yeah.
Well, Tideland. Now, that was made into a film that was directed by Terry Gilliam of Monty Python fame.
That's right.
How was that whole experience of being involved
with
the film?
It was wonderful for me. I don't know how wonderful it was for some people who were traumatized by the film, but as a writer, it couldn't have been a better experience. I had Terry Gilliam and Tony Grissoni working on the screenplay and going to great lengths to assure me that they were trying to stay as true to the novel as possible. And at the same time, I'm telling them they don't have to be. They're just generous, wonderful people to work with. And then they had me up to Canada when they were filming it and gave me a little cameo in the film. So I got to show up there looking rather skinnier than I am now. But, you know, you can look for me on a bus. I'm on a bus behind Jeff Bridges somewhere.
It's a fairly bizarre film, I have to say. I watched it the other night, the sort of the drug use and what really is child abuse, I suppose.
Yes, it is child abuse, absolutely. I will say the film is very big in Japan. Otherwise, I don't think it did all that well elsewhere. It has a nice cult following over the years, though, and I do hear from people who have come to the book through the film and are kind of rabid fans about it. But I love it. I mean, Terry Gilliam was little boys' dreams do come true. I was a Time Bandits fanatic, and Baron Munch. I loved all those films, Brazil. So at least to have been involved in it to some extent. I don't mind being a footnote, by the way, to Monty Python and Sherlock Holmes. It could be a lot worse than that.
Now, look, the New York Times has described you as an unusually sophisticated theorist of human nature. That sounds terribly grand.
It's all downhill. I mean, how do you live up to that? it was very nice of them to say so. They were very kind about this book.
Also about your novel in verse, Branches. I mean, that is a huge undertaking. Describe the process of producing something like that.
I was really shocked that anyone published it. I did it with a small press called the Permanent Press. In a way, it was an attempt to finish up a two-book deal. And I had it sitting around, and thinking, well, they may or may not accept it, but I submitted it. It actually was something I had worked on when I was at the University of Houston in the creative writing program and had set it aside thinking, it's a particularly vile story, actually. It's about a racist West Texas sheriff. It's all told from his point of view, who's thrown his stepson into a well. So it was not a book I thought anybody would really be interested in. And then it's in verse. And not, I will say, in hindsight, I don't consider particularly good verse.
Why verse? Why did you write it in verse?
It just seemed to have, you know, the way West Texans speak, I don't know how privy you'd be to this, but there is a kind of rhythm to it. So they kind of talk along at a kind of clip. They'll say things like this, and it kind of has a natural stop. So it's to get into his head, it was kind of easier to do it if I just broke it down into little stanzas and lines. I originally had started out as a short story, and it moved along fine, but it just needed some kind of, I don't know, some kind of rhythm to it or cadence to it. And when I started breaking it down into stanzas, there it was. And then we added illustrations to it, and it just became this particularly dark. It's more of an idea of what people who've never been to West Texas probably think West Texas is like. West Texas, in truth, isn't really like that. It's just a 90% sky and 10% earth. But, you know, it's a good noir kind of thing, I guess.
Rhythm and drum beats and so on are clearly very, very important to you. I want to talk about that a little bit more in a moment after we've listened to your next choice of music. Now, this is from Dave Berry. It's called The Strange Effect. Why do you like it?
Well, first of all, Ray Davies wrote it of the Kinks, and I love Ray Davies and the Kinks. So there's that. It's a very beautiful song. It's kind of haunting. It's similar to the other song he wrote around the same time called I Go to Sleep, which for some reason, I don't believe the Kinks ever recorded either of these songs. It's a pity, but it's just a beautiful song and a kind of sad song. And I like it.
Mitch, we were talking about music and how rhythm is important to you in your writing, but obviously also in your music. And music is something that's perhaps a little bit more than a hobby for you because you even have your own SoundCloud. Tell me how it feeds into your work as a writer.
The SoundCloud podcasts or mixes, I'll call them, came about. I work with my partner, Peter, on various projects, including video. And you know, we were kind of mixed media guys. And just for our own fun, just while we're around our place working, we would have music playing. So I would just put together various mixes of songs that we were kind of into at the time. And then I just started getting creative with them, playing with segues, finding little odd bits to drop between to make it all one long fluid kind of piece. And it just became kind of a fun hobby. And then I think it was Peter, he said, you know, you should share some of these. They're kind of getting squandered on us. So over the last year or two, I've been throwing one up every now and then. My goal was to do one every week, but I'm just too lazy to do that. But the more will be arriving eventually.
And people can listen to that. It's Lo-Vi Guys, L-O-V-I Guys, isn't it, on
yeah.
SoundCloud?
Yeah.
So people can actually hear that. How does your love of music play into your writing? Do the two exist together and do they feed off each other?
Yeah. You've asked the kind of question I wish someone had asked me many years ago, because these are the kind of questions I love to answer. When I would, especially early on, I always wrote with music playing behind me. Now, I don't do that so much anymore. I don't know. It becomes too distracting. But at least the first four books, there was always certain songs that I would kind of make a little mix CD. And if I got stuck, I lived in Texas, and I would get in my truck and usually very late at night and drive around. And it'd be a certain kind of songs to get me in the mood. And it would help me troubleshoot somehow.
You just so don't look like a truck driving Texan.
I've worked hard. but yeah, I went to high school in a little town called Guthrie, Texas. My senior class had 7 kids in it, and I wasn't in the top 10% of my class. So,
and you like Time Bandits and Doctor Who.
My father was living in New Mexico. It's a long story. My sister was living in West Texas. I was a troubled teenager, so they shipped me out to her. I wasn't troubled. I was a troubling teenager, I guess. But so they sent me out to the middle of nowhere to kind of make sure I wouldn't get in too much trouble or have too much fun. And that's how I spent a lot of time in West Texas.
And absorbing music, which is later kind of those emotions and that creativity kind of being regurgitated later through your
work. Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And then later on, I was living in Tucson, Arizona, and became very good friends with the music scene there, people in the music scene there, people like Calexico and Nico Case and Hal Gelb of Giant Sand, all became very close friends of mine. And I did some PR work for Nico Case and did liner notes for Hal Gelb. So if for a guy who can't play an instrument, which is also what makes music so amazing to me, because I have no musical ability whatsoever. So it does feel like magic. And writer, I think on some level, a lot of writers want to be musicians. It's just a dream to be in a band because you don't get that kind of immediate gratification as a writer. You spend a long time in a room, 2 or 3 years working on a book, and you're very insecure. Writers are really insecure bunch. And you just really want that instant feedback and that adulation that musicians can do. They can just get up on a stage and play guitar and people clap and are excited to see them. It's something wonderful. I guess reading and going to Hay is as close as it's going to get to something like that for me. Yeah.
That's the Hay Literary Festival,
right.
And Mitch Cullen is in Britain in order to be at that festival. He's the author of A Slight Trick of the Mind. Mitch, what's next for you?
Well, right now, just travel. Peter and I, we've been needing to get out of LA for several years now. I think anybody who lives in LA needs to get out of it more often. We're going to be traveling around France and Spain, but creative-wise, working on a documentary in the future based around a lot of my old Super 8 films and videos, and then we're going to have a couple of books I need to finish up. One I need to finish up, one I need to get going, and then, but before that, a photo book of old West Texas photographs from the 80s that I'm going to put together in a kind of limited edition set. So there's things going on that'll kind of creep out over the next couple of years. You know.
Mitch Cullen, an author of Slight Trick of the Mind, which is out now, published by Canongate.
Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service. Based in the heart of London with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries, we broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion. But the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks, and they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kinds of games. The games that uses the city, and the other kind is the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our Time Shift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone, and hear it all on iTunes.
I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Arianna Huffington is the editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, which she launched in 2005. In 2012, the site won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting. She's on Time magazine's list of the world's 100 most influential people and the Forbes most powerful women list. All this success came at a price, however. In 2007, Huffington collapsed from exhaustion, breaking her cheekbone and needing stitches to her left eye. She recovered, but the episode prompted a rethink of her life and resulted in the publication of the book Thrive, the third metric to redefining success and creating a life of well-being, wisdom and wonder. It's her 14th book, and it debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Well, my first question to Arianna addressed why we might need this book now.
Well, we really need to understand that there is a global shift happening away from the way we've been leading our lives and the way we've been shrinking what our lives are down to these two metrics of success, money and power. And also, this is a moment when new scientific findings have validated ancient wisdom about the importance of renewing ourselves, regenerating ourselves, about the place of sleep in our lives, about the way stress is deeply affecting our health, as well as our state of mind. So this is a kind of extraordinary moment when we have the wind on our back if we want to bring changes in our lives.
Let's talk a little about the structure of the book, because you've taken the famous 12-step program.
Yes, I've taken the 12-step program and applied it to wanting to recover from our addiction to burnout and technology. I love technology. The Huffington Post would not exist were it not for technology. But I feel we've reached a very dangerous point where instead of being the master of technology, we're becoming the slaves of technology. And we see it at a younger and younger age. We see toddlers, you know, reaching for the iPad before they reach for their parents. We see children having problems communicating with each other and preferring to text even when they're physically together. So we are beginning to be more aware of these dangers, but in order to learn to disconnect from technology, reconnect with ourselves, recharge, and then return to technology, we really need to take it seriously in terms of changing habits. So at the end of each section, there are four sections, as you know, in the book, one on well-being, one on wisdom, one on wonder, and one on giving. And at the end of each of these sections, there are three steps. And they are very microscopic. They are kind of baby steps that we can take right now to begin to make changes in our lives.
And give me an example of some of those steps. So, for instance, in the wonder chapter, what would some of those steps be?
So, in the wonder chapter, I write about what stands in the way, you know, what makes it harder for us to focus on wonder. And one of the things is basically multitasking. We are under the illusion that multitasking makes us more effective and more productive, but the science unequivocally shows that multitasking does not exist. It's actually task switching, and it's the most stressful thing we can do. And in the book, I have 45 pages of scientific endnotes to validate everything I write in the text. So, you know, walking without being on the phone or without texting, which is dangerous anyway, allows us to suddenly notice things that we had not noticed before. You know, the sort of ordinary small beauties of life that pass us by when we literally miss the moment. I know for me, you know, I live in New York, and walking down the streets of New York without doing anything else is just an incredible experience. First of all, you notice that hardly anybody else is just walking. And then I remember noticing an extraordinarily beautiful building near my home with a very delicate ornamentation at the top. And I asked a friend of mine, when did this go up? It's so beautiful. And she said 1890. So I wonder what else have I been missing?
Now, as you say, it's about redefining success. And I find that really interesting because being busy is something that we normally see as a positive. How are you? Oh, I'm busy. And that's a great thing. But actually, you argue it really isn't.
Well, we are wearing being busy like a badge of honor, like a badge of importance. And as a result, we're terrible at pauses in our lives. And yet sort of every philosophy and religion, you know, talks about these pauses, you know, the break to pray, or to have tea in Japan, or even here. You know, these are not just there by accident. They are there for a reason. There's a lot of wisdom behind pauses, and they increase dramatically our appreciation of our lives. Instead of sort of going from one thing to another breathlessly, always feeling we're running out of time. You know, this phenomenon that has been called time famine is actually incredibly stressful. And they did a Pew Research poll recently, a survey, and they found out that actually over 60% of people would rather have more time than more money. It's acutely affecting our joy in terms of how we approach our life.
How do you relax? Where does your joy come from?
So my joy comes from doing my life when I'm recharged. You know, it's like I think the greatest shift in me since my wake-up call, when I collapsed from burnout, has been sleep. You know, I get 7 to 8 hours sleep every night. You may look at my schedule and look at it and it's very full. But if I start my day recharged and I take half an hour to meditate, then I can be fully present. And my day is not stressful. There may be a lot of things happening, but the stress doesn't come from what I'm doing. They come from the state I'm in while I'm doing them. And so I now don't like myself at all when I'm tired, burnt out, and exhausted. I find myself overreacting to things going wrong. And in all our days, there are things going right and things going wrong. And I find myself not being as clear about what we're doing at the Huffington Post or in my life. So I, because of the dramatic difference in how I feel and how I am in my life, I do prioritize that.
What about the role of music in your life?
Music is incredibly important in my life. I often write with music. When I write to classical music, you know, often music I know very well, like Mozart or Haydn symphonies. I feel it sort of raises the vibration without distracting me. But I also love music that cheers me up, that gives me energy. I love country music. I love to share lists with my daughters, who are 23 and 25, and playing music that they love. I love Bruce Springsteen. So I have very, very eclectic tastes.
And you've actually got a Spotify site where people can find music that goes alongside the book.
Yes, well, there is some music that helps distress me, and music is so individual, so Spotify asked me to put together my thriving playlist, which I did.
Arianna, how do you use the tools from the book within the Huffington Post?
So at the Huffington Post, we have two nap rooms, which are always full. I think we need a third one. So if somebody is tired in the middle of the day, they can have a 20-minute nap and be recharged for the rest of their day. It was, of course, Winston Churchill who famously called them power naps. We have regular meditation, yoga, and breathing classes. We have free, healthy snacks everywhere. And I think just as important, we have an email policy that makes it clear to everyone that once they finish their work, they are not expected to be on email. So they can really be off and really recharge, be with their families, be with themselves, without having to be regularly checking if they're needed or if they have to respond to something. And we tell everyone if there is an emergency and we need to reach you, we'll call you or text you. And we're finding now that more and more companies are instituting stress reduction practices like these or different. There's a much greater awareness that the well-being of employees has a direct impact on the bottom line.
Now, you were talking about having nap pods. And of course, one of the quotes that you use in your book is Bill Clinton talking about sleep.
Yes, you know, it's so interesting that we tend to idealize burnout. We tend to think it's essential for success. But we have a lot of people who've paid a heavy price. Bill Clinton, I mean, not only had a heart attack, but also, he said that the most important mistakes I made in my life, I made when I was tired. And he did not specify what mistakes, but don't we all wish that he had had a good 8 hours sleep?
Would you support his wife's bid?
Well, as a journalist, we don't endorse candidates at the Huffington Post. It would be wonderful to have a woman in the White House. I also feel that Hillary Clinton could be a role model in how you can do everything, even the most stressful job, like running for president, and do it in a way that is less stressful. That's not the way she was when she was Secretary of State. She collapsed from exhaustion at the end of her tenure and had to be hospitalized with a clot on her brain. So that was pretty serious. And my hope is that if she runs, she will do it differently. Because at the end of her tenure at the State Department, when they asked her what she most wanted to do, she said, what I most want is to be untired. And I totally, totally understand this feeling. Mm. And so my heart goes out to her that she will find a different way to run for president than the way everybody runs for president, driving themselves into the ground and paying a heavy price in terms not just of health and well-being, but ability to make wise decisions.
Another woman, of course, who's in that position is Angela Merkel, who at the moment is having to make a lot of wise decisions or try and influence other decisions. Given your political background, what do you think about the shift that we're seeing in Europe towards the right?
Well, I think this is really a demonstration of the breakdown of trust in the establishments. So it's something we should take it very, very seriously. I feel that established political parties have done a terrible job at taking youth unemployment especially seriously and allowing it to continue while markets recover and the financial industry is doing better. But this has brought us a kind of false reassurance that things are going well. Until we solve the jobs crisis, we are not really out of the woods.
And speaking of a job crisis and everybody being very busy, it's very easy for someone, one might argue, in your position who has all this success to say, let's redefine success and let's take time in our day. But a lot of people don't have the luxury of time or indeed of significant financial backup.
Everything I'm saying doesn't require money. And it actually doesn't require a lot of time. It requires prioritizing. Everybody has a lot more discretionary time than they think. Somebody is watching House of Cards and somebody is shopping. So I think if we prioritize ourselves and our own well-being, we will find that wherever we are in our lives, whether we are at the top of the world or struggling to put food on the table, when we prioritize our own well-being, the way they tell us on planes to put our own oxygen mask first and then help others, then we're going to be more effective, more productive at everything we're doing and more resilient during tough times. You know, people who've lost their job or single moms with two children trying to make ends meet, they need these practices much more than you or I because their future will be determined by how resilient they are. And a lot of people fall apart during very challenging times. And others somehow manage to transcend their circumstances and thrive. The difference is not the circumstances. The difference is how connected they are with that place in us from which strength and peace and wisdom come. And that's why this is even more important in circumstances that are deeply challenging.
And the book is very, very personal because you go into your own deeply challenging circumstances and some terrible things that have happened and also, of course, some really good things. Have you got what you wanted from success? Has it been what you've expected?
I feel incredibly grateful for everything, including the hard things that happened because they've helped me grow. One of the hardest things that happened that I write about was my daughter getting involved in drugs in her last year in college. And even that, which she's now been sober for over 2 years, was really an incredible lesson for all of us. And also, looking back, I'm grateful that it happened while I was still around, while I could help in her recovery, and that she was able to deal with some more deep-seated issues in her life and have these incredible steps that she did herself, the 12-step program that has been so helpful to her, but I believe will also be helpful to her for the rest of her life.
Now, I know that you're an inspiration to many women and indeed many people. Who inspires you?
So other than my mother, to whom the book is dedicated and who has been an incredible source of inspiration because of her ability to lead this third metric life long before I knew anything about it. I'm really inspired by women who are very accomplished but do it differently. And one of them is, for example, Padma Sri Warrior. She's an engineer. She's the chief technology officer of Cisco. She oversees tens of thousands of engineers. And we had her speak at our Thrive conference in New York. And she said, you know, I get 8 hours sleep. I meditate. I write haikus. I paint. And every Saturday I do a digital detox. And I love her because she's just amazing, you know, and she's a role model for younger women who wonder, how can you accomplish and succeed and get 8 hours sleep? And she's one of the great role models. I think having new role models is going to be incredibly important, especially for younger women.
Finally, Arianna, the book has some wonderful, wonderful quotes in it. And there's one by Rumi that I know that you like to live your life by.
Yes, it's one that I have laminated in my wallet. It's Rumi saying, live your life as though everything is rigged in your favor. And I love that, especially during times of heartbreak and difficulty, to remember that nothing is accidental. Everything has a hidden blessing and a hidden purpose.
That was Arianna Huffington. Thrive, the third metric to redefining success and creating a life of well-being, wisdom and wonder is widely available now. Still to come on this episode of the Saturday Selection, the best of the Saturday Weekend Edition, we enjoy a fascinating look into a podcast all about smell.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
Welcome back to the Saturday Selection on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin. Life in Scents is a podcast all about smell. It's produced by Joe Barrett and it's co-hosted by Odette Toilette. Each month they invite a guest to talk about their lives through olfactory memory. They discuss the scents they love, the scents they hate, the scents they associate with growing up or with work. Anything goes as long as it's about smell. To give you a feel for what the podcast Life in Scents sounds like, we started the discussion with a short excerpt from their first ever show, which featured Amy LeMay. Odette Toilette gave us a brief explanation before the clip.
Amy LeMay is a performer and broadcaster. She does a lot of shows with the London Arts Collective Ducky, where she hosts cabaret nights in South London. But she's also had a really interesting career. She was the first lesbian mayor of Camden in North London. And she came to one of my events and she just loves the sense of smell. So we invited her on as our very first guest when we started the podcast. And we couldn't have hoped in a way for a better interviewee. She really loves smell.
Every night when my dad would come in home from work, he smelled like he'd been down a sewer for 9-10 hours. But you know, when you're a child, the most exciting moment of the day is when your dad comes home from work. I love port-a-loos. I embrace them. I love the smell. I love the smell of open toilets when I'm in France. I love the smell of sewage. I love, you know, that kind of like that European drainage smell, all of that. Because to me, that is the smell of my college education being paid for. To me, that is the smell of my very first car as a gift when I was 17. To me, that is the smell of my father's blood, sweat and tears in building up his business and providing for his family.
That's a wonderful piece, and it really does give you an idea. Because really, I would have first said, how on earth do you get smell across on the radio? But you clearly can.
Absolutely, and it's... There's something about it. If you're watching a film, you can just sit back and it'll tell you exactly what to do. But with radio, you have to fill in the gaps and you have to use your own memory and your own experience. And it's very immediate and it's very emotive. And smell works in a kind of very similar way. It's even talking about smell can put people in exactly that moment. We interview a lot of people who do speak about their lives quite a lot. And you can feel them. They come into the interview with a kind of set idea about how they expect their story to go. But even mentioning something or will spark off a memory of something in their childhood, and you end up seeing this narrative kind of meandering all over the place, and people will end up speaking for hours and they'll sort of get reminded of things that they might have not talked about for years even. So it's quite an interesting way of opening people up, we find.
And your life story, how did you become to be associated with smell in such a strong way?
For me, it's something which has just developed and developed. My mum always said that when I was a baby, rather than reaching out and touching things or putting them in my mouth, I would smell them as a first way of understanding what an object was. And my friends noticed that even now, if I come across something new, the first thing I will do will like instinctively put it up to my nose. So I think it's just a general interest I've had, which I've kind of just pursued and pursued and pursued and pursued, sort of working out in all the sort of strange olfactory things that I do now.
And Odette, how did it start for you?
Well, I was young and I came at it from the smell, yes, but also perfume. I had a birthday party when I was a child, and you know, you get given all these random presents and get them home at the end of the afternoon while you're high on sugar. And my favourite was this bottle of Tinkerbell cologne or something like that. And I just thought, this is it. This is the best present ever. But it got confiscated by my mum, who later was to really nurture my interest in perfume. But at that time, she thought, oh, you're far too young for this. And she took it away. So I was so upset. And then I thought, why has she taken that away? And that's where it all started.
Now, tell me about the website that you run apart from this one that you do together, about Odette Toilette.
I started running events about 4 years ago about smell, slightly before Joe and I began the podcast. And I wanted to create a place online, but also sociable evenings, where people could come together and discover their sense of smell, think about perfume, but very much from a cultural, historical perspective, rather than just talking about the ingredients in the latest launch of whatever, you know, whatever's new in the shops. And so it really grew into a bit of a community. And so there are all sorts of people who come online or come to the events. Some of them are really into perfume, or they work in something to do with scent. But others, you know, it's that serendipitous thing where you suddenly get an interest. There's a moment where you get turned on to smell, and that they come and find me, and they come and find the events.
Because talking about the history of smell, I mean, there was a major revolution, wasn't there, when it was discovered that you could create various things synthetically. That must have opened up an enormous world.
It was so exciting, and it's almost a secret history in a way, because it all happened around the Belle Epoque period, that innovations in chemistry and in technology started to feed through to the perfume industry, and these synthetic molecules started to be experimented with. And that meant you could make perfumes that didn't smell just like nature. You could make abstract perfumes. I mean, one of the first big ones was a fougère, which means fern, and which sort of imagined what a fern would smell like if it had a smell. There were others around that period that imagined the smell of clover. And then from there, we've moved on and on. And an interesting question is, the first people who ever got to wear these perfumes, did they realise what they were smelling? You know, it must have been so exciting to have a sniff.
Absolutely. Do you spend your whole life sniffing people, Jo?
Yes.
Watch out, he'll be after you.
I am very interested, though, that how that translates, though. I mean, you've talked about how it works on radio, but you mentioned the descriptive words and how important that is when you're relating to a smell. If you're told that it smells of leather and tobacco, do you instantly think masculine?
Yeah, well, I mean, lots of people talk about the fact that we don't have a language for smell and a way of talking about it, and there just aren't the words in our language, and we're not trained in our culture to be able to discuss it. But that's one of the joys of doing the podcast, is to talk to people about it and kind of like eke out how people experience the world through smell, because it's fascinating. Some people are able to just talk about it by relating it to kind of colours and sounds and that kind of thing. And some people are very matter of fact. And it makes for a huge range of different interviews.
Jo, I'm interested in finding about branding and smell, because you're involved with that.
Yeah, I'm involved in all sorts of things. But one of the things I'm doing at the moment is looking at companies and brands and how they use smell in what they do. And specifically what I'm looking at is how smell relates to the other senses. So how it relates to touch as part of the customer experience. Sending your customers on a journey in a hotel, for instance, maybe in the lobby, what you want is a kind of a smell which gives a sense of arrival and sort of alertness. Whereas in the rooms, you want something which is relaxing, maybe something like lavender, which is sort of in aromatherapy terms, is actually sort of proven to help people like physically calm down and relax. So it's kind of a way of just making brands think about themselves in more than just the visual, because often branding is seen as it's just a logo. And there's just so much more you can do to create a mood and create a sense of what the message of that brand wants to say.
And are people taking that up? I mean, we've chatted in the past here to hotel music curators, who basically make sure that you're taken on a musical journey through a space. So the bar will have upbeat, lively music, or other public spaces have different music to create that feeling. Are they actually taking you up on it? Are there smell curators, olfactory curators, if you like, in public spaces? Or is it just at this point an idea?
It's something which I'm working on, and it's something which there is a huge amount of interest, and people understand it and are excited by it, but because it's not done very much, people are a bit kind of nervous to jump in. But I'm definitely noticing, and Odette, probably you will agree, that there seems to be a sort of increase in interest in the sense of smell, but also sort of sensory experience generally.
Now, talking about hotels and sort of trying to create a mood, drinking smells and drinking music. Tony Congliaro, I think that's how you pronounce his name.
Yes, that's very good.
Now, he's a mixologist. Tell me a little about him and then we'll hear what he said to you on your podcast.
OK, so Tony is a bartender and mixologist. I think he's quite keen on the bartender element of it, but he's an incredible guy. Like he does the drinks for the Fat Duck.
And that's Heston Blumenthal's sort of scientific-based restaurant where he experiments with all sorts of foams and fumes and things.
Yeah, it's incredible. And he has a lab in Angel, and we went to interview him here. And this is an incredible space where he spends all day with this team of passionate scientists, just sort of hundreds of bottles of perfume and flavours on the wall, just kind of experimenting with different things. The day we went there, he was distilling pine for a pine gin and tonic, which I think is still being sold in his bar 69 Colbert Row. And this, I mean, you can just imagine that smell of just like kind of bubbling thick pine was incredible. You can sort of feel and taste the experience of enjoying this drink when you listen to this clip, I think.
We found an amazing drink that was in one of Marcel Proust's books. And he describes how when he was feeling a little bit down, he used to put tiny little pellets of ambergris in his hot chocolate to lift his spirits. And ambergris, if you smell it, is a bit kind of full on, but it's very deeply, erotic in a way. So it's kind of that mixed with hot chocolate with a bit of cognac. I mean, everyone had to be very careful that evening because you just got whacked on the back of the head with this kind of set of desires that was just like, it was a very, very odd experience. But I don't think I've had a drink that has been that full on.
And if that doesn't make you want to tune into your podcast instantly, I don't know what will. That's Tony Congliaro. Now, his bar is where? Yeah, it's Colebrook Row.
69 Colebrook Row in Islington, but he also works close by, so not so good for listeners further away, but the Zeta Townhouse in Clerkenwell. He was the guy behind the bar there as well.
Now, tell me, Odette, you have your own sniff and scratch events, as we were saying, and talking about various smells, but do people's perception of smell change in relation to their cultural heritage? So if people are in different countries, is what smells good different?
This is a really interesting question. It does and it doesn't. So there has been quite a lot of research to understand the hedonics of smell and whether you can have universal principles. Would someone in Japan be pleased by the same smell as someone in Alaska? And there are very few smells that are universally known. I think one of them is chocolate and one of them is vanilla. But, even with vanilla, it's often seen as a savoury smell in Japan versus Europe and North America. I think cultural background is crucially important in so many smells because you learn whether something is safe or not. You learn whether you associate something with an urban context or rural context, depending on where you are. But when we started the podcast, we were worried that people from a very particular life background talking about their smells, would someone internationally recognise that or feel alienated by the podcast, if they're talking about something really specific. But the funny thing is, and I should qualify this by saying a lot of our guests are from the UK or Europe, but people bring up the same smells and a lot of them are very much universal. The smell of rain always comes up in the podcast and the smell of sun cream always comes up. And there are these touchstones that seem to be reference points for so many people, no matter how wealthy or not they were growing up, whether they were country dwellers or grew up in the city. And that's what's so interesting. The more people we interview, the more we realise that core collection of aromas doesn't ever really vary that much. And then you get the quirky bits like Amy LeMay loving the porter cabins we talked about earlier. But there's this sort of this nucleus.
Now, there are very definite families of smells, aren't there? I forget how many there are, but there are sort of the prime numbers of smells, if you like.
Yes, you have, particularly in fragrance, the industry for perfume or for shower gels is categorised into fragrance families. So you might have citrus and hesperidic, or you might have sheep, which is the mossy green ones, or oriental. And they've been the sort of classifications that we've lived by and by which we buy perfume, but they're not actually that useful, I don't think, as a navigation tool, because, okay, so something's floral. Well, you might like one floral and hate another. And actually, the way people want to explore perfume is actually much more creative than talking about ingredient families. And that's something, you know, a lot of people are looking at this at the moment. For example, Selfridges in London is currently running Fragrance Lab. And the idea behind that is you go in and they analyse your personality, and you, I won't go into too much detail, but you choose shapes and different colours, and you're put through a process that's nothing to do with talking about smell. And at the end of it, they give you something, they give you a bottle, which, you know, you don't want to talk about flowers. And I think that's really interesting.
Incredibly interesting. And do you think that it changes people's perception of who you are if you smell a different way?
Oh, yes.
I mean, for instance, I read recently that grapefruit can make you smell 6 years younger, not 5 years or 7 years, but 6 years younger.
Incredible.
It's quite specific.
But it is like, I mean, citrus fruit does have that kind of fresh, energising quality, which is one of those universal things that you find.
When I do an event, and often I'll bring historical vintage perfumes from the 1920s to the 40s, and the remark you get all the time with those is it's grandma's handbag. You get, it comes up so often, this idea of an old smell versus a young smell. I always think it's a bit like someone's name. You know, there are certain Christian names that are classic, and then other names that seem terribly young and trendy. And as that generation ages, suddenly they're dated, they're passé. And it's funny, I think the same thing happens with smells, and we don't necessarily realise it consciously, but we're always judging, you know, does that smell like my gran, or does that smell like a teenager out on the pool? We know it, we just can't articulate it.
Tell me about this next clip we're going to hear. Now, this person is the public astronomer at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich.
So Marek is, I think he's one of our favourite guests, and he's certainly one that, when listeners speak to us, say that they really enjoy. And Marek's really good because he was very unsure that he would have something to say. And this makes him one of our kind of favourite subjects, because the clip we're going to hear is him talking about his job as a research astronomer, which involves going out, flying out to islands in the middle of the Pacific, as far away from anything as possible, on a mountain, so as close to space as possible. And he just talks about the life through the stuff he was smelling there, what his lifestyle's like. And that's the beauty of the show and the joy of the show, is to kind of like get these insights into people's lives and to kind of think about what they do in other ways. So he's an astronomer. You kind of think about him in terms of his work and what he says about the stars. But there's lots of specific things about his life which are actually, I mean, I just think they're quite touching and quite beautiful and quite romantic.
You go to places like Hawaii, the Canary Islands, and even though you think of these as being very warm places, when you're 2.5-3 kilometres above sea level, it's actually quite cold and quite a harsh climate. And what is very evocative for me is the plants that grow up there are very sort of hardy little shrubs, you know, with these tiny sort of waxy leaves and very kind of resinous wood when you brush past them, when you're sort of having a little break between getting your observations ready in the afternoon. And so actually something that makes me think of those observing trips, quite exciting being up there using the telescope, is that smell of those really hardy resinous shrubs clinging to the tops of these mountains.
And that's Marek Kakula, who's the public astronomer at the Royal Observatory Greenwich, and that was part of an interview he gave to Life in Sense, the podcast all about smell that's produced and hosted by Joe Barrett and also Odette Toilette. I wanted just to finish off by talking about podcasts and the rise of podcasts and the sheer material that's needed to sustain all these various different podcasts that we're now able to get. So, Joe, I know you've got quite strong feelings on podcasting.
I wouldn't say strong feelings. I find it quite interesting because I'd say we can sort of split our audience from the various ways we get to know about our audience into kind of two categories. One category is people who love perfume rather than smell. So perfume bloggers, beauty bloggers, that kind of thing sort of interact with us quite a lot, which I think is interesting because, yes, we're about smell and we use smell as a thing, but really we're not a podcast about smell. We're a podcast about people and their lives. It's just a tool to go into it. But the other section of people who listen to us are people who are fans of podcasts. And I always think it's quite interesting because they're not fans of radio necessarily or fans of the subject matter. They're fans of podcasts. And I think it's fascinating that there's a kind of a group of people who are fans of a delivery system for information rather than what the content is of it. Mm. And it's nice and it's interesting.
And Odette, I mean, you've come to this more through the smell pathway, if you like.
Yes, I think radio or specifically podcasts. When Joe we were first talking about doing Life in Sense and getting it going, and Joe, you did a sort of trial episode where you interviewed someone in the industry, and it was one of the loveliest things I'd ever listened to. And it can be really hard to communicate the sense of smell. You know, it doesn't work well visually. That's the whole point of it. And while people, you know, when I talk to people about smell and radio, they're always going, oh, can you project the smell into someone's living room through some kind of microphone while they listen? But you don't need that. It's amazing how just hearing people describe smell works. And I think the thing about podcasts is it is a niche subject. Life in Sense is a very particular angle. But, you know, it doesn't matter now. With a podcast, you can come up with a funny little quirky line in on a subject and find an audience, and I think that's really nice. And we're constantly kind of surprised as to who's listening in and how far it's spread around the world.
And you're able to chart that, yeah?
Up to a point. Mm. Yeah, we have listeners all over the world. Particularly, I don't know, particularly in kind of hot spots of where the perfume industry is big, yeah. Which is interesting. The other thing about podcasts, which I just wanted to say, is about it's kind of about attention. So people download them and choose to listen to them in their own time. And I think you do need a kind of sense of focus to kind of listen to the kind of radio that we make for this podcast. And I think we talk about this quite a lot, but I think the ideal listening situation for Life in Sense is in the bath.
Definitely.
Because you can really sort of just like lie back in a sort of sensory deprived sense and just let these people's memories and stories wash over you.
How wonderful. And if people would like to do that, where do they find your podcast?
So we're on iTunes. You can just search for Life in Sense or lifeinsense.com.
That was Joe Barrett and Odette Toilette, the people behind Life in Sense, a podcast all about smell. Well, that's all we've got time for on this episode of the Saturday Selection, where we give you some highlights from Monocle 24's Saturday Weekend Edition. This episode was produced by Claire Urban, and I'm Georgina Godwin. Join us again to hear some of the very best of the weekend's interviews here on Monocle 24. And of course, you can always catch us live every Saturday. And if you'd like to get in touch, it's gg@monocle.com. Thank you for listening.